This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The consequences of the new technological revolution are about to hit hard. Unemployment will spike as new technologies replace labor in the manufacturing, service, and professional sectors in an economy that is already floundering. And Robert McChesney argues in People Get Ready, the fight against a jobless economy and a citizenless democracy, that only the dramatic democratization of our economy can address the challenges we now face. Senator Bernie Sanders, actually, in praise and promotion of People Get Ready, wrote that they, Robert McChesney and John Nichols, call us, as Tom Paine did more than two centuries ago, to turn knowledge into power. Now, Professor McChesney, who has authored and edited 23 books, whose work has been translated into 31 languages, helps us to figure out how we can turn knowledge into power. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Mimi.
Well, certainly it's an essential challenge of these times to ensure that technology is used to serve the whole of humanity rather than to enrich further the wealthy few and create the circumstances that drives the working class into joblessness or habitual state of precarity. Bob, how or why really have you chosen this moment to become the town crier to warn against the advance of technology from robotization and artificial intelligence and its effect on our being able to earn a livelihood?
It's a book really as much about capitalism, current capitalism, and the current lack of democracy as technology, but technology is a dynamic element that is really going to produce tremendous changes in that context. And I think the idea for the book began in 2014 when Eric Schmidt, the CEO at Google, gave the keynote at Davos in Switzerland, which is the annual meeting of all the world's financial, business, and political elites. They discuss the great problems facing them and the world. And Schmidt said to his fellow billionaires and global leaders that Google then and other companies in the United States and worldwide were working on a wave of technologies that in the very near future were going to wipe out most of the middle-class jobs, and that a large chunk of jobs that people had taken for granted were going to be eliminated by business and technology in the coming decade or two. And what Schmidt said that was striking to us was that unemployment and underemployment and just sort of general downward pressure on working conditions and wages would be the number one political issue worldwide and in the United States for the next 20 or 30 years. And he said it in such a striking manner that it got my attention, my co-author John Nichols' attention. And we were wondering, first of all, if Schmidt was telling the truth or he was just blowing smoke. And secondly, we were wondering why no one else was talking about this outside of elites, if in fact this was true. And we did the research. We read the business engineering material on automation, robots, artificial intelligence, what's taking place in labor practices, and indeed confirmed that what he is saying is pretty much acknowledged by people who study the matter closely. And then we looked around and said, well, if this is the case, why is it that's nowhere really to be found in our political debates, in the broader political discussion among the population? It's purely, at this point, a discussion of elites by and for elites. And that's when we decided this is a book that really needs to be written.
Is the issue, as a result of this, the wiping out of jobs, the wiping out of the middle class and the working class, is the issue that the democratization that is referred to really means that the U.S. working class has to push aggressively for a new economic structure in which technologies are applied to effectively address environmental and social problems, unlike that would be used by the capitalist class?
Absolutely. I think that is precisely the logical endpoint of the discussion. I mean, there's really, in elite circles, there is an understanding that the immediate consequence of of the ability of businesses to switch to these new labor-saving technologies. And again, when we talk about this, it's not simply extraordinary robots in manufacturing. But we're talking about very few jobs that aren't going to be, they're not in the process right now of being greatly automated. So it cuts all across, I mean, up to professional-level jobs and above that these will affect. And if you talk to elite circles, they're arguing, they understand that in the near term there's going to be massive dislocation. And that's what they're looking at, because for businesses they can save so much money by investing in robots, artificial intelligence, computerization of employment. But they sort of hold the faith that in time, business will come up with new jobs, new sectors, and they will all live happily ever after. And there's a certain amount of history to back this up. I mean, most people worked on farms in the 19th century, and when farming became far more automated, or at least productive with machinery, those workers left the land and they went to the cities and found jobs in factories. And when factories became far more productive with machinery, those workers went into offices and other places, and it seemed like there were all these jobs that eventually came around to work for people. With the exception, perhaps, of the Great Depression. And we think that that's the argument we hear today, but there's really no evidence for it. And we studied it pretty closely and looked at the claims. And I think those that actually examine the claims understand that there isn't another wave of tens of millions of jobs that's going to show up. But this revolution we're in technologically is so profound that it is really the equivalent of the steam engine, if not greater, in terms of the impact it'll have on the economy. And that we're completely unprepared for it within our current political economy. It's going to immediately accrue benefits to those who run the government, who run the policies, and who own the economy. And the benefits for the rest of the population are purely, at this point, hypothetical, and almost would require magic to come about.
And why wouldn't capital, not seeing the kind of impending disaster, although one could certainly project a closer movement to fascism, but why would it not then say that we really need to expand the technology into greening the economy, for example, and virtually put itself out of business or create a real crisis, since it still needs a consumer class to buy its products?
Well, you're right, and there's just now the beginning of that sort of discussion in elite circles. I think at this point, there's so much still people, even in elite circles, or especially in elite circles, will hold on to the magic of the market combined with the magic of technology, which is this very powerful cocktail that people drink in this country, that they think the same technologies that eliminate all these jobs will be creating new ones, and they think the technologies are so wonderful they'll overwhelm the temporary disruption that they anticipate. But there are some who understand that we're looking at a situation where unemployment and underemployment and downward pressure on living conditions, already a major problem worldwide, even before we talk about this, and that's the context we're in, already a huge problem in the United States, not only in communities of color, which are sort of the first ones who've experienced the massive wave of warehousing of people and underemployment and unemployment, but really stretching all across large chunks of rural America today, turning much of the rural United States into effectively Appalachia. And with all this going on, that there's going to be a major problem. And I think right now they're struggling to come up with solutions that will save their economic system, save the privileges of the wealthy, so they can still have the wonderful benefits they've had, but have a stable society where people won't be so uppity they'll take to the streets and raise hell and disrupt what would otherwise be a lovely experience for the people who own the robots, own the companies that make the money. Somehow they want to salvage capitalism. So there is that debate from an elite perspective, how they can keep their system going. But there's not a debate yet, and there's not a movement yet that actively and aggressively says, well, how do we turn the situation into a plus for the bulk of the people in the United States and on the planet? And that's what we're trying to stimulate with this book.
Well, how do you see rejuvenating and extending democratic organization and movement to challenge this jobless future?
You know, what's ironic is when we started this book about a couple of years ago, we did our research on it. We went and we looked back at the 1930s. This was the last period where we had massive joblessness and underemployment of a long-term nature, not just of a brief slump, but deep and protracted. United States and much of the advanced capitalist world, unemployment rates got in the 20, 25, even 30% range. Extraordinary numbers. Even today, we'd be, that's something we can hardly fathom. And we looked at what happened politically in those environments. And what we found was that there were basically three things that happened in massively unemployed situations. One, the center usually collapsed, the mainstream, the establishment, usually mired in corruption and ineffectivity, and they couldn't come up with solutions that could get the economy working again, and they were in the pocket of those who were not willing to make change. So, that was one thing that occurred in most countries. Secondly, we found that as the center collapsed, as the mainstream collapsed, there were two great movements in Western capitalist societies. One tended to be things like we associate with FDR and the New Deal, which were progressive movements that tried to empower the working class, had the government enter and play a progressive role in creating jobs, lowering inequality, strengthening democracy, and strengthening the economy, and then building and actually making capitalism, ironically, work better by building up a working class with incomes to buy stuff and giving capitalists an incentive to invest because they were sitting on their capital. And the other side of the coin, though, as we well know, is that's the birth of fascism, as we know it in the modern sense. Without massive unemployment, the Nazis never would have come to power in Germany. That, everyone who studies Germany gets that. I mean, Germany was not some backwater hit country. Germany was, the most dominant cultural, economic, and political force in Germany in the first part of the 20th century. And no one thought it was possible to have the fascists take power there until shortly before they actually did. Mm. And so we projected, as we started in our research, that as that situation arises in the United States and worldwide increasingly, we should see the center collapse. And certainly the center in the United States politics is completely corrupt and is not especially productive. But we'll also see movements here, we argued, for democratic socialism on the left and for fascism on the right. And when we first wrote this in our first chapter about a year ago, we sent it to our editor in New York, and she said, you can't write something about democratic socialism and fascism in the book for Americans. They're never going to buy that. That term means nothing. Those terms mean nothing here. And then a few months later, she wrote back by the end of the year and said, you guys, this was, of course, after Sanders and Trump made their moves, that you guys might be onto something here. And I think this is sort of the general scenario we're going to be seeing politically, and not just in the United States, but worldwide, as solutions to the crisis. They're going to be emerging. We're seeing them. They're emerging, in fact, this year much faster than we had anticipated. Both the Sanders and Trump phenomena have come much faster. And they are, in the end, I think, why they're so profound is that they are bottom responses to the great changes taking place to the bulk of the American population, something the corporate news media and NPR sort of stuck in their upper class, Upper West Side, Beltline cocoon, have no idea that's going on. They're still completely clueless about.
When I was reading the book, one of the things that I went back to, certainly looked at the 1930s, and I want to pick up on that in a minute, but I was also thinking about the agenda rising in many ways of Martin Luther King Jr. when he spoke towards the issue of another America, and what we looked at was the three pillars, if you will, of capitalism, the wealth disparity, the income distribution, the poverty, and the U.S. militarism, and the culture and practice of discrimination and disparate treatment that really curses through the political bloodstream of America. And I think that's very much in the book, and actually one might almost talk about that as the agenda in terms of structuring or restructuring and working to democratic institutions that will address this impending catastrophe. And I'm just wondering about your thoughts on that, and also if you can pick up more on some of the, shall we say, point headings that were addressed from the 1930s that begin to give us a sense of how to proceed.
Yeah, I'm glad you make that point, because our argument is that the crisis that's coming is a political crisis, first and foremost. I mean, it's fed by technology, and it's fed by a capitalist economy that's been mired in stagnation for some time now, and is only going to get worse thanks to what's coming with the technology. But it's a political crisis, so that's why we look so closely at the 30s and 40s, because that's when we had a similar situation of massive unemployment And we wanted to look and see how the response was then. And what was striking to us doing our research was that President Franklin Roosevelt was really almost obsessed with fascism and defeating it by the 1940s, by the Second World War, when the United States and the Allies were battling Germany and Japan. And he framed the entire Second World War as the battle of democracy against fascism. And he really spent a lot of time thinking, what caused fascism? What do we have to do to prevent fascism from returning anywhere in the world, and especially in the United States? He had no illusions that fascism was just something you find in other countries. He understood well that there were the same problems and threat of fascism here in the United States. And what's striking is that he gave two great speeches in the Second World War to define fascism and what needs to be done to defeat it. These were not minor speeches. They were not sort of things he said that someone dug out of his archives. These were sort of framing speeches for his entire administration and legacy that he gave in the 1940s. And the first one was defining the war against fascism, Second World War, as the war for the four freedoms. And the four great freedoms included the freedom from militarism. He understood militarism was a key part of what makes societies anti-democratic and undemocratic, and it was a key component of fascism. It was the policy they always turned to as the one way to stimulate the economy that wouldn't threaten elite interests. And also the freedom from want, that a democratic society had to have, a genuinely democratic society to exist and survive, had to have people who were secure and not in fear of their own survival materially. And then in 1944, he gave what I believe is the most important speech of his political career, the State of the Union Address. He's looking at the end of the war, and he argued that the Constitution of the United States had to be expanded, and we had to add a number of amendments to guarantee the security of the people in order to guarantee that fascism would never return. And it's called his famous Second Bill of Rights, or Economic Bill of Rights speech. And in that speech, he said that we needed to actually have a rights in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights. We had to have another set of things that were guaranteed to everyone in America, a job at a living wage, housing, food, health care as a right, education as a right, and the right not to have monopolies dominate the economy. Because he said fascism is invariably when private monopolies, capitalist firms grew so large they took over the government and made it their own plaything and destroyed the credibility of democracy. And so he argued this is what we needed. Now, he didn't get that passed. And we go into this in great length in the book. We talk about the tremendous influence that speech and that those ideas had worldwide and have to this day. But he died before anything could happen there, and it never got passed, obviously. And the Cold War sort of swept much of that impetus for that under the rug. In the 1960s, Martin Luther King and the great labor leader, A. Philip Randolph, when they put together their freedom budget and their vision for how America should go, drew liberally from FDR's vision of how America should change into much more of a democratic socialist or social democratic society and much more egalitarian society. And then it's interesting to bring it full circle. Last year, when Bernie Sanders was asked to define his vision of socialism, at your speech at Georgetown University, he basically started with and drew from those two experiences, the experience of FDR's State of the Union Address to the Second Bill of Rights and Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph's Freedom Budget. Said this is really the great American tradition we should understand for dealing with the crisis we're in now and the sort of society we should be building. And I think so the hopeful part of our book is there are rich traditions there to draw from. We're not going into this clueless or without anything to learn from, and that there's really a vision for how we can get through this and make this, instead of being some sort of cataclysmic crisis of, you know, dystopian Mel Gibson type movie, instead be something that could be truly extraordinary.
So we're also advocating, instead of necessarily becoming a Luddite and going around and smashing up all the machinery, which there may be something to be said for, I really encourage people to get ready to read People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, because we've just skim the surface. There's so much more, looking at the issue of progressive taxation and looking at the issue, of course, that came out of the 30s of the GI bills and other things, that we really need to effectuate an agenda towards the end of transformative social and political structures. I just want to take a moment, since you're such an expert in this area and since you brought up Bernie Sanders, etc., while we're again telling people to get people get ready, and perhaps we can get Bob McChesney into New York on a sponsored book tour with WBAI. But your views on the way the media has looked to the primarily, I would say, the Sanders and the Trump campaign. I'm still reeling from the very first announcement by Trump in New York of his virulent hatred, which was voiced so prominently against various ethnicities, particularly people of Mexican descent, et cetera. And yet there was not a peep of any significance from the papers that covered it. But I'm giving my speech here. Your thoughts?
Well, that's a great question, and that is definitely hard to answer in a short answer. But I will just put it bluntly like this, or in a simplification. You know, in Dollarocracy, a book I wrote with John Nichols about money and media and politics that came out a few years ago, you know, we looked at all the literature, and it generally shows that corporate mainstream media, NPR, are not don't have a bias between Republicans and Democrats. They have a bias towards front runners who tend to have a lot of money, and they tend to treat them the best. But, you know, I think that whole logic collapses when you introduce someone like Bernie Sanders into the mix. Unquestionably, the data shows, and I think the anecdotal experience shows, that the corporate news media and NPR are spoon-feeding us sort of Hillary Clinton stuff. I mean, it's almost like her campaign is sort of the news director at every one of these stations. And Bernie Sanders is just treated like, you know, a pariah, and has been all along. It's been quite extraordinary. I've never seen anything quite like it. And I think it establishes where, when you strip away the hot air and get right to it, he is a genuine threat to the sort of moneyed establishment in this country that owns the media, and that the world of the journalists, all of them, including the MSNBC crowd, is very much tied up in the success of elites like Hillary Clinton and the mainstream, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And so it's really been quite stunning to see the nature of this media coverage as I've seen it unfold. And Trump, on the other hand, there, you know, his situation is, again, quite interesting, too. And it's a little different because it's a different set of criteria. And he's gotten such extraordinary coverage, and he's gotten away with the sort of comments you made that would have been career-enders in the past for anyone to make these sort of outrageous statements. And the list is so long, you can hardly remember them all at this point. Yet he still gets a ton of coverage, and since these criticisms of him haven't stuck, and the media will not hit him hard on some of these issues in a way they ought to. So this year has been, I think, perhaps the single most depressing year for looking at what passes for political journalism in the United States and how truly pathetic it is. And it makes it the need for stations like this one, for independent news media, that much more imperative, and thank God we have it.
And thank God we have you. You know, there's a little blurb on, or three words on the cover of your book from Noam Chomsky, lucid and informed. it's to the point. People get ready. The fight against a jobless economy and a citizenless democracy, Robert McChesney and John Nichols, must reading, great name. The book pops out at you if you go to a bookstore, and we thank you for spending some time. And I hope you can come back more frequently, and we can also continue to deliberate more on how the media is really disempowering us by helping us not make the right decisions to indeed democratize our society.
Well, I'd love to do that, Mimi, and thanks for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure entirely. Robert McChesney, People Get Ready. He helps us do that.
I can feel the spirit building, soft as a whisper, but loud as a roar. I can been quiet too long, my friends, but the work involved.
Has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.